silently for me. Silently for me.
What you listening to, son?
I don't think you like it.
Well, why not? I like this new generation of music.
What the?
Where did you record this?
See, that's the type of...
It just makes me want to... That's my boy! Yeah!
Things I Will Keep, Thursday, 7 to 9 p.m. on 101.9 FM. Things that
I will keep. I have been advised to listen to this record.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Surveillance of journalists, and you know, this goes for surveillance of dissidents, it goes for surveillance of political opposition members that we see in the film and in the world now so often, is not just information gathering. Surveillance of this type is intimidation, and it shrinks the space for all kinds of expression in democracies.
Is that a spy in your pocket? In this holiday special, we speak to Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Ronan Farrow about Surveilled, his new documentary looking at how surveillance spyware is threatening democracy across the globe. We'll also discuss how the incoming Trump administration could use the technology to hack your phone. Plus, we look at Trump's war on the press as he sues the Des Moines Register for publishing a poll before the election that showed him trailing Kamala Harris.
I think you have to do it because they're very dishonest and you need a fair press. And the press says, no, I see others. I have a few others that I'm doing.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show looking at a new film that examines the increasing use of spyware targeting journalists, human rights advocates, and dissident voices around the world. The HBO original documentary Surveilled follows the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Ronan Farrow as he uncovers how Pegasus and other surveillance programs are threatening democracy across the globe. This is the film's trailer.
Why should people around the world care about the hacking that you're documenting here?
These cases affect 450 million people. It's a violation of their rights.
What we ended up finding was actually the tip of the iceberg.
Spyware is this powerful surveillance tool. Big spyware companies say they sell this tech only to governments. But this multi-billion-dollar industry is mostly unregulated. The most advanced spyware can turn your smartphone into a spy in your pocket. It can copy everything and record you without you ever knowing, and then just disappear without a trace. This company, NSO Group, makes Pegasus, advanced spyware reportedly deployed in at least 45 countries. With allegations, it's being used to target journalists, human rights activists, and political dissidents.
What's the most objectionable thing that you saw in your time at the company?
One of the moral problems that I had was the journalist murder.
Should people be concerned?
Definitely, yes.
Does NSO know that some of its customers are abusing this technology?
This tool could fall into the hands of the Iranians, the North Koreans, the Chinese. We need our experts to know what is out there.
They targeted my family. My mom, she worked at the hospitals, so they had access to hundreds of data of patients all around the world.
Do you think it's headed down a path of more domestic impact?
These technologies, any various use that we can imagine, we're probably going to see.
The trailer to the new HBO original film Surveilled, now streaming on Max. The film was directed by Perry Peltz and Matthew O'Neill. Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez and I recently spoke with Matt O'Neill, the film's producer, Ronan Farrow, who is also contributing writer at The New Yorker. I began by reading to Ronan from a recent article in The Guardian that notes, quote, In 2017, while reporting a story on Harvey Weinstein that would, along with a New York Times report, kick off the Me Too movement, the investigative journalist Ronan Farrow found himself the target of covert surveillance. The efforts to suppress investigations into Weinstein's history of sexual abuse, for which the Hollywood mogul paid the Israeli private intelligence firm Black Cube, were mostly old school, unquote. I asked Ronan Farrow to lay out what happened to him.
Well, I got a firsthand view of the toolkit that powerful institutions and individuals can deploy when they're trying to suppress reporting. And I saw it on a miniature scale where one mogul did this frankly insane maneuver of retaining a private intelligence company that literally hired actors, former military and intelligence people from Israel, to play roles and insinuate themselves into individuals' lives who are around the story. That included sources that I was working with, women who, as it turns out, had allegations of assault against Weinstein. It included journalists working on the story, including me. And so there was a two-pronged approach. There were people posing as people who wanted to talk to us, wanted to get close to us. And then there were also subcontractors who were hired to just do the traditional gumshoe work of staking people like me out. I had two guys outside of my apartment. And eventually I was able to get the contracts and all the signatures of the lawyers and prove that this operation was happening and get sources inside this company, Black Cube, to describe what they were doing. And actually one of the subcontractors that was following me around all the time, sometimes using some high-tech approaches too, pinging my phone, getting my geolocation data so they could follow me to meetings, one of them became a source in the end. So I wrote a book about this, Catch and Kill, and there's a documentary series on that if people are interested in more. But I did, through that experience, through this relatively low-tech approach to surveillance, get a little picture of how personally devastating it can be to have your private interactions monitored in that way. In this case, there were real stakes because I was talking to whistleblowers around this story who were risking everything and couldn't be uncovered if I wanted the story to go forward. And I also saw how unsafe it makes you feel. Surveillance of journalists, and you know, this goes for surveillance of dissidents, it goes for surveillance of political opposition members that we see in the film and in the world now so often, is not just information gathering. Surveillance of this type is intimidation, and it shrinks the space for all kinds of expression in democracies.
Yeah, Ronan, from that that relatively low-tech type of surveillance to what we're confronting today and in recent years, how did then you decide to cover this aspect of the high-tech surveillance?
Well, through that reporting, I developed sources in the Israeli private intelligence world, and I spent some time in Tel Aviv. I spent some years getting close to people in this industry, in this world, and I clocked through my own experiences just how pivotal a challenge this is. For anyone who cares about maintaining people's basic rights and maintaining the free flow of information in democracies in order to protect those rights, surveillance, I realized, was a linchpin. It wasn't some sidebar issue. It was one of the tools that people use to try to suppress democracy, to suppress the free flow of information. It is part of the authoritarian playbook that we see historically again and again, that police states emerge where there are oversteps into privacy violations. And I realized as I was looking at this issue and experiencing these dynamics as a journalist myself, that the bleeding edge of this kind of surveillance, and the thing that was transforming it and making it more available and more intrusive and scarier, was this modern spyware that can take control of phones at a time when we're more and more enmeshed with our phones. And I realized that this was one of the foremost challenges confronting journalists around the world, and also one of the challenges that anyone, even if you don't think of yourself as being in a vulnerable category, you're not an activist, you're not a dissident, you should care about and should understand, because phones are increasingly not private spaces. I dealt with, in addition to being followed around, dynamics where personal information was leaked around stories. I worked on stories about Trump's collaboration with the National Enquirer that ultimately helped catalyze that indictment around Trump and the hush payments. And during that reporting, I also had, you know, intimate texts leaked. You know, there were all sorts of efforts to use private information as a lever. So I was just seeing how again and again, if you want to expose the truth, if you want to be a voice of opposition to power, you're inevitably dealing with this kind of surveillance. And I was seeing how the highest tech version of it was the scariest, was the most secretive, was the most poorly understood.
So tell us about Pegasus and this amazing film, Surveilled, takes us to Israel, takes us to your investigation of the company and who the company is selling to.
So the biggest players in the spyware market, which is now a multi-billion dollar industry, and it mostly is comprised of companies that want to stay secretive. So there's not a lot of reporting on this. There's not a ton of public-facing websites. Companies that do have a kind of public-facing presence, they don't actually talk about what they do or who their clients are. This is one reason why the reporting was necessary. Now, in this multi-billion dollar industry, the big players claim, in a bid for legitimacy, that they only sell to government offices, mostly government intelligence agencies, government defense offices. But the technology that's privately available for purchase by those offices is now cheaper, more efficient, more intrusive. So what you're seeing is two categories of change. You're seeing governments that previously didn't have the size and the resources to have a CIA-style high-tech surveillance operation just buy a kind of CIA in a box. You know, we talk in the film to officials in small Western democracies who love this technology. And by the way, I should point out, small Western democracies where the populations of those countries don't yet know that this technology is being used against them. And, you know, we hear from those officials how they think it's great that they can ostensibly, in some of these cases with warrants, but much more freely and cheaply just hack into people's phones as needed in law enforcement operations. There are legitimate arguments for the use of this technology, like with any surveillance technology. And theoretically, in those Western democracies where there is a process to get a warrant, this is something that shouldn't have to be scary. But what we see over and over again is that it just gets abused. I would argue inevitably. Surveillance technology has historically always been abused. Now the technology is more advanced and more frightening than ever and more available than ever. So abuse is more possible and more ready than ever. What we've seen in the last few years is not only that repressive regimes with a poor human rights record are using this technology against journalists and against dissidents, against political opposition members, and sometimes, by the way, with dangerous and even deadly results. There have been studies that have linked hundreds of cases of violence to spyware technology. A lot of the players involved, including NSO Group, deny this, but NSO Group's flagship technology, Pegasus, was allegedly found on the phone of at least one associate close to Jamal Khashoggi in the time frame when he was murdered by the Saudi regime. We see this over and over again. Javier Valdez in Mexico, a great reporter who was working on cartel stories, was killed. People around him had Pegasus on their phones. So that's the pattern under repressive regimes. But we're seeing not only that, but also one Western democracy with an ostensible commitment to human rights after another see scandals in which this technology is purchased and then overused. We've seen it in Greece. We've seen it in Poland, where just this week, a former spy chief in that country was actually arrested as part of inquiries into a massive spyware dragnet that happened under the previous administration there. And we've seen it in Spain, where some of this film is set and where we helped document this massive cluster of hacks where the Spanish government, which you wouldn't think would be a player that would be responsible for this kind of a breach, they just hacked one civil society member after another associated with a separatist movement, but a peaceful one in Catalonia.
And Matthew O'Neill, you're the director of the film, and specifically the focus of the film on Spain and the independence movement in Catalonia. What most surprised you in doing that work in Spain.
Well, I think when Perry Pelt and I first sat down with Ronan, and Perry's the other director of the film, when he started talking about the way his reporting was leading to Spain, we had heard of Pegasus. We think it's a really important subject, this cyber espionage. We associated with autocracies, Saudi Arabia, imagine the capabilities of a Russia or a China, but that this was happening in Spain, and that Ronan was sitting on the cusp of exposing what at that point was the largest cluster of Pegasus infections inside any one place in one group. I think it started with 67, now it's in the hundreds. Our eyes were opened because it felt like this story, what was unfolding in a democracy, in a U.S. ally, was something that people needed to know about. And our idea, as we talked about how to tell this story, because Ronan's reporting was already so extensive, was what could we do to give the audience access to Ronan's process and see the reporting and the discoveries unfold. And that's part of what makes Surveilled, I think, really interesting. Perry and I have been longtime admirers of Ronan as a journalist and a reporter, and this gave not only us, but all of you at home, the opportunity to ride along shotgun with him.
So this is a clip from the HBO documentary Surveilled, in which our guest, Ronan Farrow, speaks with the Citizen Lab's Elias Campo in Catalonia.
Why should people around the world care about the hacking that you're documenting here in Catalonia?
So this is going to be one of the first cases where there's such a large and vast number of affected people, and from a vast and different type of categories of society. So we've had the Parliament of Catalonia targeted, we've had the government of Catalonia targeted, we've had lawyers targeted, we've had civil leaders of cultural organizations of Catalonia targeted.
This is not some future Orwellian scenario. It happened here. It's happening here.
It's happening here.
And this is another clip of the HBO documentary Surveilled, featuring Jordi Soleil, a Catalan politician, former member of the European Parliament.
The iPhone will generate a diagnostic file which won't include personal data. We just received confirmation that your phone was hacked twice, one on the 11th of June and then again on the 27th of June.
2020.
When does it look like you were infected?
I have to check the date, but around that day I was appointed member of the European Parliament.
How do you feel knowing that you may have been compromised in this way?
Well, I feel surprised and angry at the same time.
So that's the Catalan politician, former member of the European Parliament, Jordi Soleil. And before that, Elias Campo, who is the investigator. He lives in Barcelona. His sister and parents were also, their phones were infected with Pegasus. Ronan Farrow, if you can talk about the significance of this, and it goes to the whole issue of you've got a spy in your pocket. Exactly what are the authorities, those who are paying for this, the information they're getting from your phone?
Well, everything, potentially. People have to start realizing that their phones are now public spaces in so many ways. Even if you're just a person using your phone in a run-of-the-mill way and you don't think you're in one of these vulnerable categories, anyone with the resources can hack your phone if they want to. Any country, even places where there are supposed protections of privacy rights, are now battlegrounds over this technology, where we are seeing people like the sister and parents of Elias Campo, who you mentioned, who are apolitical, getting caught up in surveillance dragnets. I've been, in my ongoing reporting in recent weeks, talking to privacy law experts who really stress at this point that one should know about this and care about this and exercise good digital hygiene and get the protections that you can, maybe even get your phone tested. Whether you are again, in a vulnerable category or not. And so in this case in Spain, you saw people like Elias's parents, who are just doctors, have all of their patients' sensitive records and photos and scans just, you know, divulged to whoever wants to use them. All they know is the government now potentially has all of this information.
And the phone becomes a microphone?
Pegasus and other similar computing technologies can turn on your microphone without you knowing, can turn on your camera and record video without you knowing, and send all of that information back to whoever has purchased and is working with NSO or whatever the spyware company is to operate the technology.
And Ronan, what if a person did want to disinfect their phone if they suspected that they were being surveilled? Is there a new industry arising now to basically check phones? And are we seeing sort of an arms race between the surveillance folks and the anti-surveillance folks in terms of these smartphones that almost virtually everyone has in their pocket?
Well, when I talk about the world now being a battlefield over this technology, one of the fights, one of the fronts in that battle is between the technology companies, the platform holders that operate your operating system on your phone, like Apple, that operate your messaging applications like WhatsApp, and on the other side of the battlefield, the spyware companies. So in the film and in my print reporting, I talked to both the programmers at, for instance, WhatsApp, who every day, there's a team within that company, within Meta now owns it, looking at what are the attempts to intrude on this technology? What are these, at times, astonishingly creative technical solutions that allow this technology to worm its way into your phone through little vulnerabilities in the code? And then I also talk to the programmers at, for instance, NSO Group, who are really proud of that daily fight where they find creative solutions to get into the phones, and who have to exercise a lot of rationalization, frankly, is my view, in the face of all this evidence that those efforts are being misused and abused to target vulnerable people.
So in the film Surveilled, you interview a whistleblower, right, at NSO. Ronan Farrow interviews an NSO whistleblower who's asked for anonymity.
So you're hacking these phones. What kinds of reactions did you get?
It's jaw-dropping. It's very impressive the first time that you see.
What was the pitch that you were offering these governments?
Usually we had like one iPhone, one Android device. We used to demonstrate how we can exfiltrate the data from those devices, actively take snapshots of the screen or pictures from the camera, actively record through the microphones.
What should the average citizen in any country in the world know about this company and this technology?
It's very powerful. It's very intrusive.
Should people be concerned?
Yeah.
We're telling these governments how to exfiltrate the data, he says, and his voice is disguised as you talk to him, an NSO Group whistleblower, and they make Pegasus. So if you can talk about the U.S. buying this technology from Trump to Biden.
Under multiple administrations of both parties, we have seen overreaches of surveillance technology. Under the first Trump administration, the New York Times has reported extensively on this, there was actually a purchase of this very technology, Pegasus, which again can seize control of a phone, turn it into a listening device, disgorge all of your private data, by the FBI. So the FBI purchased later, Christopher Wray, the FBI director, told Congress just for testing purposes, a Pegasus account. They did it through a subcontractor. Later, the New York Times sued for more information that showed pretty clearly that this was not clearly delineated just for testing purposes. There was a whole conversation within the FBI where they wanted to deploy this potentially on American soil in an operational, very real way. Now, as far as we know, that didn't happen. That stopped. And under the Biden administration, there have been halting efforts, at least of a limited quality, to curtail the use of this technology. There's often dissensus and tension across the government on this. I know of cases that have not yet been made public where Department of Justice offices, where Department of Defense offices have purchased foreign private spyware technology to help in their efforts, because not all of these offices have the resources of the CIA. Now, the Biden administration, in response to my reporting calls, did announce, and we disclosed this for the first time publicly in one of my New Yorker stories, an executive order where they essentially said foreign spyware that has a record of being abused can't be, shouldn't be purchased by the U.S. government. But the standards for what meets that criterion are really amorphous. And what we've seen since then is that the U.S. government has gone right on purchasing more spyware. Just this past fall, we saw the Department of Homeland Security, and there's been reporting that this is specifically ICE, the Immigration Office under the Department of Homeland Security, purchase another really powerful Israeli spyware technology called, it's a company called Paragon, and the technology is called Graphite. And, you know, I have sources within that company. They do bill themselves as a more ethically clean alternative. And one of the things that they promised the U.S. government in the vetting process that led up to this multi-million dollar contract was that they would put restraints on how other clients, other foreign governments that use their technology, can use it to hack American citizens. But we don't know how exact those restraints are. And more to the point, there are no restraints on hacking people in America, including Americans, by ICE itself, by the Department of Homeland Security itself. And privacy law experts have been in a state of high alarm about this, partly because they point out that the Department of Homeland Security is often the U.S. government office that purchases ethically and legally questionable technology and is able to circumvent a lot of scrutiny by arguing that they have a law enforcement national security basis for using it. So you now have a perfect storm, Amy, of technology of this type that's really powerful and really easily abused in the hands of the U.S. government, again, under the Biden administration. The Biden administration has, in response to reporting on this just recently, paused that contract. They say they're reviewing it. But the thing is, right around the corner, the Trump administration is coming in. And we can talk about this, but obviously the Trump administration is bringing in a raft of officials and Trump himself who have made explicit threats against the groups that, again and again, in Western democracies, have been most vulnerable to this kind of espionage. And there's just a lot of terror, really, in the circles of sources that I have, these privacy experts, these watchdog groups, also fellow journalists, about what is going to happen with this technology if even those halting efforts to curtail its use and put guardrails on go away.
Pulitzer Prize winner Ronan Farrow and Matthew O'Neill talking about their new documentary, Surveilled, that's streaming on Max. We'll return to our conversation in a minute. Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We return to our conversation with filmmaker Matthew O'Neill and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Ronan Farrow about their HBO documentary Surveilled that's now streaming on Max. The film looks at the dangers of spyware like Pegasus, which was developed by the Israeli firm NSO.
Given the fact that Israeli industry has become such a main source of this surveillance technology, do you have any indication that it's basically United States military funding that goes to Israel, that government then contracts with its own so-called private companies to develop this technology?
In an attenuated way, there absolutely is that flow of resources. Israel has become a cradle for innovation in this kind of technology for a combination of reasons. I mean, Tel Aviv is a center of tech innovation in general. They have a great pool of tech talent. And Israel is set up in a very specific way where there's mandatory military service. People at a pretty early time in their careers go into government, military, and intelligence units. And then also pretty early in their lives and careers, they come out of that service and they apply those skills and that knowledge in the private industry. So you have companies like NSO Group and companies like Black Cube that Amy mentioned that do more traditional human intelligence operations that have all of these resources directly from a government that is, of course, as you point out, supported largely by the United States and its military aid. So a lot of these solutions are Israeli as a result of all of those factors.
How much does Israel target Palestinians? So we've talked with reporters like Yuval Abraham from 972, who exposed Lavender and Where's Daddy, where they follow people home, Palestinians in Gaza. Of course, we know about the exploding beepers and phones in Lebanon. And then I want to ask, did you ultimately take down the head of NSO Group, which makes Pegasus?
So first of all, on this question of targeting Palestinians, the reporting suggests, yes, there have been a number of documented cases of spyware technology being found on the phones of Palestinian activists, politicians. We talked to a Palestinian former Knesset member, politician in the film, who puts forward the theory that Israel essentially uses the Palestinian populations as a laboratory for this technology. And, you know, one of the reasons why private spyware companies thrive in Israel is that in addition to the Israeli government's internal, very robust capacity for this kind of espionage, there's always a demand for more of this kind of tech, including from private vendors, to deploy in the conflict that surrounds Israel at all times. Because they are a highly militarized state beset by all of these existential threats, and especially now in this state of conflict, there is just always a context in which to apply and refine this technology. And there has been additional reporting that in this most recent conflict as well, there's been a deployment of Pegasus in an effort to try to track hostages. Now, of course, there's controversy within Israel. People see some of the intelligence failures around this latest conflict, and there's right-wingers who in that country say, well, there should be more use of this technology. But certainly to your question, people who care about the agony of Palestinians right now, I think should be aware that this technology has wormed its way into this conflict and that this conflict has reinforced the development of this technology. To your question about the leadership of NSO Group, I would not say that I took out the head of NSO. The head of NSO was, as we acknowledge openly in this film, a source of mine. He did depart that company amidst a lot of the scandals. The company was very embattled, and then there was a leadership change. The reporting of a whole consortium of international publications, a lot of different outlets, I think, contributed to those scandals. I would say the foremost player in disclosing information about this company was the watchdog group that we track in the film, Citizen Lab.
And Ronan, what could the outgoing Biden administration do to curtail the ability of the incoming Trump administration to use the powers of this technology? Or what could Congress do that you think, given the makeup of the Congress, of the new Congress coming in?
This is where it gets really tricky and, frankly, even bleak. And I think this is why activists and journalists tracking this issue are in a state of such alarm. The Biden administration, the executive branch, can do relatively little as far as I understand, that can't be undone by the Trump administration. More robust executive orders, you know, are a possibility, but the Trump administration, A, can pass its own executive orders, and B, has just shown an unprecedented disregard for the rule of law. So not only are there existing loopholes, not only can those loopholes be widened, but we may have a set of players coming in based on their own statements who just disregard the entire framework and overreach in various ways. You see a clear, concerted effort in Trump's appointments in this new cabinet and wider administration to circumvent the rule of law. You see the selection of someone like Kash Patel, who would very clearly give Trump free rein to manipulate law enforcement investigations if he were running the FBI, and has suggested that the executive should have absolute power, has suggested that journalists should be prosecuted.
This is Patel speaking to Steve Bannon on his podcast, The War Room.
We will go out and find the conspirators, not just in government, but in the media. Yes, we're going to come after the people in the media who lied about American citizens, who helped Joe Biden rig presidential elections. We're going to come after you. Whether it's criminally or civilly, we'll figure that out. But yeah, we're putting you all on notice. And Steve, this is why they hate us. This is why we're tyrannical. This is why we're dictators, because we're actually going to use the Constitution to prosecute them for crimes they said we have always been guilty of, but never have.
That's Kash Patel, the Trump nominee for head of the FBI to replace Christopher Wray, who was already called on the carpet around buying Pegasus. So when not only Kash Patel, because who knows if he'll make it, but President Trump has repeatedly talked about journalists, for example, as the enemy of the people. Your final thoughts, Ronan?
Trump and his associates have explicitly threatened journalists with prosecution, and specifically threatened journalists who protect their sources with prosecution. That is dangerous for democracy. This is one of the first times, and I'm, as we discussed, someone who's dealt with a fair number of surveillance and intimidation efforts, that I've felt frightened to work in this country. I think in this incoming administration, we're going to need the work of journalists more than ever, and we're going to need the space for journalism, for dissent, for all of the spaces that are shrunk and cracked down on when you have this technology freely used in an unfettered way. And we've just seen this horror story play out in one country after another, even where there are ostensible protections in place. We see how hard it is to get accountability after the fact. We see how tempting it is for law enforcement to overreach and start to target people in a vindictive, politicized way. And then you have these sets of statements where you have Donald Trump threatening political opponents with military tribunals, for instance. And as ever, we're in the media engaged in this debate of what's a joke and what's not. But these kinds of appointments, or at least attempted appointments that we're seeing, are no joke. And this technology that is already at the fingertips of this government, that's no joke. So people need to really care, and members of Congress of whatever party who remain sane in a context that is increasingly not normal really need to clock and appreciate this issue. I have seen in talking about this film in public spaces how the public gets it, how ordinary Americans understand that it is scary to have these spaces shrunk and cracked down on. And I think that politicians who take a stand and realize that the spyware companies in this film who say this is a weapon of war, the spyware companies themselves, we have NSO's lawyer on camera in the film saying there's no equivalent to the Geneva Conventions for this, and that's not on us. We're making and selling a weapon that is largely unregulated. We've got to fix that. And I think people care is what I'm seeing. And my hope is that political representatives understand that the people care. And this is not a partisan issue. You know, people who don't want big government, people who have traditional conservative values, should especially care about protecting people from this tech.
Matt O'Neill, you traveled the world with Ronan, as you interviewed people almost on every continent. I want to ask you, for example, about Guatemala. In 2022, a group of journalists working for the award-winning Central American independent news outlet El Faro filed a lawsuit in U.S. court against NSO Group, the Israeli company that operates Pegasus spyware, used to monitor and track journalists, human rights activists, dissidents. The El Faro journalists, which is based in El Salvador, allege Pegasus software was used to infiltrate their iPhones and track their communications and movements. Now, you didn't go to El Salvador. They sued, and one of the heads of it went to Guatemala.
Yes, we went to Guatemala City to interview Roman Gressier, who was targeted by Pegasus spyware. And I think this is indicative of what you see on every continent where Pegasus is in use, is that you're seeing journalists, civil rights activists, human rights activists who are being targeted with this software. If you're looking at El Salvador, this tool is only as responsible as the people using it. So in El Salvador, they're prosecuting journalists. In Saudi Arabia, they're tracking down and executing journalists. If we have this software here, I think people listening at home might be thinking, I'm not going to be subject to an ICE investigation. The Department of Homeland Security isn't interested in my selfies or my pictures of my kids. And that's likely true. However, if this investigative tool makes it into the hands of people who have an expansive idea about what criminality is or what the reach of their institution is into people's lives,
or proudly announce their enemies list they have,
we will all be caught up. We don't need to be the target of an investigation. They could be targeting you, and our text exchange this morning would have looped me right into that.
So, if you can talk, Ronan, about what you do, Juan asked you this question before, but really specifically, it amazed me how simple some of it is, and of course, much more complicated to stop this level of spying.
Well, simple, but it's not foolproof. You know, I have been told by senior people within spyware companies that rebooting your phone every day is a great practice.
Why?
It doesn't foil all of these forms of technology. Reboot survivability is built into some of them. But others, including, at least when I last checked in on it, Pegasus, will actually have to reinfect you after a reboot.
Meaning turning your phone off.
Just turning your phone off every day is a good digital hygiene practice. Again, not foolproof. And increasingly, these technologies are more and more sophisticated and can survive reboots, but it will clear out some types of spyware infections. Also, this may seem obvious, but just keep all of your devices updated in every way you can. I mentioned that kind of Mr. Robot digital sniping between the platform holders like Apple and Meta and the spyware companies. What that means is that every single day there is a multi-billion dollar industry that is geared towards finding the vulnerabilities in the latest Apple patch, the latest WhatsApp patch, and exploiting them. And on the other hand, there are teams of sophisticated programmers within the companies that make your software and your hardware that are spending their lives creating those new patches to close up those vulnerabilities. And we see some of those battles in the film, if you're interested in learning more. But the end result is update everything all the time. When you get that little alert, it's annoying, but don't wait.
Aluminum foil?
Well, we follow a scene in the film where a live infection is found of another type of spyware technology, Kandiru, and Citizen Lab investigators race to the scene, and they have the activist who's been infected wrap his laptop, where the infection is taking place, in tinfoil to create a Faraday cage, like you get when elevator doors close and you lose reception, to interrupt the flow of data in and out of the laptop and hopefully prevent a signal from being sent to it that might cause the technology to delete itself. In that case, it was successful. They managed to prevent the technology from self-destructing, and they got a live example of how this infection was working, and it actually helped Microsoft generate a patch that thwarted this technology for a time. So tinfoil, theoretically, or even better, you can get Faraday bags that in secure settings sometimes people use to interrupt transmissions to their devices, can theoretically be a help. But I wouldn't count on it because you got to wrap those things really thoroughly. And I have also talked to sophisticated technology experts who say, you know what, that's really far from fail safe.
And Ronan, did you find in your investigation any companies or platforms that had better practices in terms of securing individual phones against surveillance?
Well, you know, I have been impressed, whatever you think of the wider companies, with the commitment of the programmers who are playing defense on this issue within Apple and within WhatsApp. You know, these companies are sometimes secretive about what they do on this front. Nobody likes to publicize that the device you make or the software you make is so vulnerable. But I'm grateful to the sources within those teams who spoke for this reporting and to the cases in which the companies in question, Microsoft or Meta, for instance, agreed to participate even in the film. You know, we have people going on camera talking about how they do this. I think more openness about this is called for, and that people should celebrate the cases in which companies put resources into protecting their customers in this way. There's not enough, but there is some going on, and that does deserve acknowledgement.
Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Ronan Farrow and Matthew O'Neill talking about their new documentary, Surveilled. It's streaming on Max. It's directed by Perry Peltz, Matthew O'Neill, and produced by Ronan Farrow. We'll link to Ronan Farrow's New Yorker piece, The Technology the Trump Administration Could Use to Hack Your Phone. When we come back, we look at Donald Trump's war on the press. Now, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show looking at Donald Trump's renewed war on the press. The press, which he's often called the enemy of the people. Trump recently sued the Des Moines Register, its parent company Gannett, and the pollster Ann Seltzer for publishing a poll before the election that showed him trailing Kamala Harris in Iowa. While Trump ended up easily winning Iowa, he's now accusing the paper of committing, quote, brazen election interference, unquote. Trump laid out his plans to target the Des Moines Register and other news outlets during a news conference at Mar-a-Lago.
And I feel I have to do this. I shouldn't really be the one to do it. It should have been the Justice Department or somebody else, but I have to do it. It costs a lot of money to do it, but we have to straighten out the press. Our press is very corrupt, almost as corrupt as our elections.
Trump's lawsuit against the Des Moines Register came just days after ABC News, which is owned by Disney, settled a defamation lawsuit filed by the president-elect. The network agreed to donate $15 million to Trump's presidential library and pay $1 million in legal fees to Trump's lawyer. Trump sued ABC after its anchor, George Stephanopoulos, said Trump was found liable for rape in a 2023 civil case in Manhattan brought by writer E. Jean Carroll. ABC has been widely criticized for agreeing to settle instead of going to court to fight what many believe to be a winnable case. The prominent attorney Mark Elias responded to the settlement by writing, "Knee bent, ring kissed, another legacy news outlet chooses obedience." Juan Gonzalez and I recently spoke to Chris Layman, D.C. bureau chief for The Nation, who wrote an article headlined, "Trump's attack on the free press is just getting started." I started out by asking Chris to lay out what's happening.
Well, what's happening is a very clear pattern in Trump's public life. It actually well antedates his rise to political power. He made a practice of frequently going after journalists for defamation. He famously sued one of his biographers who wrote in his this biography that Trump did not qualify as a billionaire. And in his subsequent deposition, Trump basically said he was a billionaire because he felt like a billionaire. This is a longstanding pattern of just intimidation of the press. And Trump was very open as a private business person that that was his aim. He wanted to exert a chilling effect on people doing critical reporting from him. Now, of course, he has the awesome power of the federal government behind him, or prospectively behind him, and ABC disgracefully capitulated right away. And the Des Moines Register suit is a clear auger of what's lying ahead. At the Mar-a-Lago conference you mentioned, Trump also threatened to sue Washington Post reporter Bob Woodward. The Pulitzer Prize, Pulitzer Peace Prize committee for these, you know, alleged offenses against basically Trump's bottomless vanity. So by capitulating, you know, sort of preemptively the way ABC has, this news organization has set the stage for a torrent of similar suits like this. You know, Trump will end his henchmen like Kash Patel. Also, Pete Hegseth has threatened a defamation suit against the person alleging sexual assault against him. You know, this will be a prime MO of the second Trump administration. And it's very worrisome that even before Trump takes office, ABC is without cause, you know, giving in. It sends a very distressing signal. In point of fact, what George Stephanopoulos said on the air was just a paraphrase of what the judge in Trump's, in the E. Jean Carroll case, said. He said that even though Trump's conduct in the case did not rise to the strict definition of rape under New York law, any common sense understanding of rape suggests that Trump did, in fact, commit that act. So
the judge said that.
The judge in the case. So there is not, this was not George Stephanopoulos just randomly popping off on the air. It was a documented claim.
And Chris, I wanted to ask you, in the Des Moines Register lawsuit, Trump is alleging consumer fraud by the Des Moines Register as a weapon. Could you talk about that particularly, and also the impact on these media companies, of many of which tend to want to settle just to get rid of a lawsuit?
Right, right. The fraud charge is, you know, as far as I know, has no legal basis. You can't, you know, just say because a pollster got something wrong, there's some deliberate intent to mislead. It's a plainly frivolous suit, but that is the point. This is a show of power on the part of an administration that we know from its prior turn in office takes every opportunity to demonize, harass, and intimidate the free press. The Des Moines Register suit is very much like the Trump biography suit I mentioned earlier. It's just his vanity was affronted by poll findings that, you know, turned out to be wrong. You know, I don't know what he can assert the damage has been if he won Iowa by 15 points after this poll was released. It is just a plain effort to harass and intimidate. To its credit, the Register's parent company, unlike Disney, which owns ABC, indicates it will be putting up a robust defense and you know, in a sane court system, they will prevail. But, you know, all of this takes resources and money. And as you mentioned, Juan, you know, big companies don't want to be bothered with the hassle of, you know, going to court, even though, you know, these companies also have libel insurance precisely for cases like this. And they don't actually, you know, tend to suffer in terms of the bottom line.
I mean, this is extremely serious. When you look at the amount that ABC settled for, they were just about to go to depositions, right, of George Stephanopoulos and Trump, to discovery. So ABC called that off. $15 million plus another million for lawyers' fees. Any smaller news organization couldn't possibly deal with something like this. Then you have these news divisions that are not, you know, profitable. They only profit democracy, but a so-called, you know, financially profitable from these multinational or these very large corporations that are own lots of other things like Bezos with the Washington Post.
Right.
And they care more about that other stuff. They don't want to be seen unfavorably by Trump. So they settle on the news issue. This is so extremely disturbing.
Yeah, and this is what happens when you have large corporations who are not, they don't have journalistic values, they don't have journalistic priorities. You know, as you said, the news operations are lost leaders for these figures. And Jeff Bezos has billions of dollars in government contracts, a publisher of the LA Times. It's the same story. He has extensive pharmaceutical holdings that are come under federal regulation. So he, too, is preemptively knuckling under to the Trump administration. He's killed editorials critical of Trump. He's installed this absurd new feature for readers of the paper to track bias, and he's insisted that anything critical of Trump run alongside in the op-ed section something that's the opposite point of view. This is more than just callow both sidesism. This is just craven corporate misconduct.
That's and Patrick Soon-Shiong, who owns the Los Angeles Times.
Thank you. Yes. So, yeah, this
Chris,
is what happens.
I wanted to ask you, we only have about a minute left. I wanted to ask you about the potential, what Trump could do with the FCC, especially in terms of broadcasters. Are there any concerns in that area?
Oh, absolutely. Cameron Barr, his nominee to head the FCC, is a very vocal critic of, you know, what in MAGA land is considered, you know, mainstream media censorship. He's gone on and on about how big tech in particular is, you know, during COVID and at other times have allegedly suppressed pet MAGA causes and talking points. So, there's a very real and immediate danger of, you know, the call will be coming from inside the White House soon when, you know, Trump's FCC starts implementing policy. And it is all of a piece. It's really important to underline that, you know, what we're going to see, I think, is what happened in Hungary under Orbán's rise to power. Trump and J.D. Vance are both ardent admirers of Viktor Orbán, and Orbán basically used his version of Elon Musk to buy out the national press and turn it into a you know, party propaganda arm. And, you know, that is a very real and present danger with Trump coming back into power and feeling this kind of impunity and this drive to avenge the people he sees as his enemies. It's crucial that the press hold the line and, you know, follow the example of the Des Moines Register and not the example of ABC News.
Chris Layman, D.C. Bureau Chief for The Nation, will link to his piece, Trump's Attack on the Free Press is Just Getting Started. And that does it for today's show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Anjali Kamat, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warnoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamarie Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, and Hannah Elias. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan, David Prue, Dennis McCormick, Matt Ely, Anna Osbeck, Emily Anderson, Dante Ferrieri, and Buffy St. Marie Hernandez. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
The Corridor is an award-winning news program hosted by Dinah Jansen and Jesse Bell, airing every Thursday at 5 p.m. on CFRA.